How can we tell whether a child might have symptoms of ADHD versus simply having difficulties in their attention? When should a child receive a clinical evaluation for ADHD? What can teachers do to help these students in the classroom? And how do ADHD medications work? I will answer all these questions and more in today's episode. I am Cindy Hovington, and this is Curious Neuron. Welcome to Curious Neuron, a podcast about child development and education with information that is backed by science. I am your host, Cindy Hovington. I have a doctorate degree in neuroscience and postdoctoral training in education. My specialties are understanding how the brain develops and how play promotes learning. I love searching through science articles to see what I could apply with my own three kids, and I want to share this information with you. Follow Curious Neuron on Instagram to vote for the topics I'll cover and to send in your questions for the experts. For more information, visit us at CuriousNeuron.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Curious Neuron podcast. So according to the American Psychiatric Association, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, is characterized by symptoms of age-inappropriate inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. ADHD is one of the most prevalent childhood disorders, with a worldwide prevalence of around 7%. There are still lots of misconceptions when it comes to ADHD, and I feel that we use this term very quickly whenever a child isn't focused or is being hyperactive. But ADHD is a lot more complicated than just moments of inattention or hyperactivity, which is why I wanted to cover this topic extensively. So today's episode, as well as the next episode, will both focus on ADHD. Let's get started with my interview. My guest today is a neuropsychologist who works at the CIRC clinic here in Montreal. She does neuropsychological evaluations for both children and adults. I had the pleasure and honor of being in her lab during my PhD studies, which is why I'm really excited for this interview with Dr. Audrey Benoit. Hi, Audrey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm really happy that we can chat about this topic. You know, when I posted this question online, I got inundated with, you know, emails about like with their questions, parents, yeah. Early childhood educators, teachers, and just wanting to know, you know, more about ADHD. So mm-hmm. I think we have a lot to talk about today.
Yes. No, I could see that you sent me a couple of the questions that you got. And they're very good questions, very specific questions. That will require like a very organized answer.
Oh, okay. Let's see if we can get that to them. Mm-hmm. So I think where I want to really begin is I was on the understood.org website this week, and I was just curious to see which myths were still common around ADHD. And the one that they wrote is that a common myth is that ADHD really isn't a medical condition. And mm-hmm. I think that this myth will open up a lot of conversation around, you know, why does this myth persist? But then what is ADHD? You know, what mm-hmm. is it a condition? You know, what are the signs and symptoms? So let's talk about it in general.
Right. Yeah, the basics. So, first to start, ADHD is 100% real. Okay, it's not something made up. It is a neurodevelopmental disorder, which means that it's something that you're born with, and that relates to how your brain develops and how the different parts of your brain talk to each other. And it is definitely a medical condition. There's a few reasons. ADHD is it's kind of a special disorder, and there's many reasons for that. First is it's one of the only disorders that's been named after its symptom and not after its cause. Mm. And it turns out that its symptoms are extremely non-specific, meaning that a lot of people, normal people who don't have any difficulties, have experienced at some point in their lives inattention or motor agitation. Mm-hmm. It's also normal in the development of a child. A child that's like, no child is born with the innate ability to focus on something for long periods of time. It's something that develops over time.
On its own or with help?
It does require help. Like for sure, like if you'd never foster like a sustained attention, if you've never fostered it in your baby and your toddler, for sure is they're going to have difficulty developing it. But also there's just biologically, the brain is going to mature, and the regions, there's specific regions related to sustained attention that are going to mature and that are going to help the child focus for longer periods of time. And so that's the thing. If you talk about, when I talk about ADHD, just for the sake of our conversation, I will say ADHD, whether I mean attention deficit disorder with or without hyperactivity.
Okay.
So I include both. And if there's a difference, I will differentiate them. But there's mainly two clusters of symptoms. There's the inattention symptoms, which is difficulty being focused on the same activity for a long period of time, having difficulty also not being distracted by everything that's irrelevant around you.
Mm-hmm.
There's the hyperactivity cluster. This is combined with impulsivity. Impulsivity is part of hyperactivity. It can be motor. So a child that gets up all the time when they shouldn't, runs around when they shouldn't, or make gestures like a pushes people when they shouldn't, mm-hmm. but also verbal impulsivity. So when they interrupt people or talk incessantly, for example. So this is part of the hyperactivity cluster of symptoms, and it's thought to be present in it's approximately 5% of children. We definitely do talk about ADHD a lot in,
yes.
I think in Quebec. I don't know if it's really like that
That's
everywhere.
That's true.
We do so, yes.
I mean, with the symptoms that you just described, mm-hmm. I think you just described every toddler that I've seen or even
right.
in my own home. Mm-hmm. So how is there a specific age for diagnosis when it comes to ADHD?
Right. Yes. Well, when we're looking at the symptoms, what we're looking at is these symptoms unusual for the developmental age of the child? So it's going to happen in every toddler, but they should mm-hmm. grow out of it at some point. And if they don't, that's when you have a problem.
Okay.
We are usually more careful when putting a diagnosis for children that are under 8 or 9 years old.
Okay.
Starting at 8 or 9 years old, that's when we're starting to be the most sure of our diagnoses. And it's something that's common to a lot of neurodevelopmental disorders is that there's no blood test. There's no genetic test that you can do. Mm. There's no brain scan that you can use to diagnose it without a doubt. So there's always that we try to eliminate the risk of false diagnosis as much as we can, but there's always going to be a small percentage where it can't be 100% certain.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
So when we diagnose a child under 8 or 9, sometimes we won't specify a severity level just because they're quite young and we want to give their brain a chance to keep maturing and see how things will fall into place in the next 2-3 years. Or we might sometimes put like a provisional diagnosis or like possible ADHD to be confirmed, like either with a follow-up evaluation in a couple of years. But yeah, starting 8 or 9, that's when we're the most sure of our diagnosis.
And do you think that in our society, we're using the term ADHD too much, or that we're jumping too quick to conclusions when we see a child who's mm-hmm. perhaps their temperament or their behavior is a bit more hyperactive than others?
Mm-hmm. Right. It happens. And I think it's a kind of a vicious cycle of we talk about it so much that mm-hmm. it's in everybody's mind all the time. So when there is a problem, I think that's the first thing that comes to mind to a lot of people, like whether it be teachers or educators in kindergarten or whatever. Mm-hmm. Even for clinicians. But like, as I explained earlier, because the symptoms are quite unspecific, or like they appear in a lot of, it means that there's a lot of other conditions that can look like ADHD.
Okay.
And ideally, what you would want to do is eliminate all the possible causes of inattention or agitation before you say, okay, we've eliminated everything that it could possibly be. Now we think it's probably ADHD. Mm-hmm. That's what's left.
So could a child just have an attention difficulty without having ADHD?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not talking here about individual weaknesses. So we all have things that we're good at and things that we're not as good at. So this is a disorder that has a neurological basis. So when we're saying that the ADHD is there, it means that there's a very significant difficulty, not just a weakness.
And these weaknesses, when it comes to the brain and, mm-hmm. and you know, a child who has ADHD, if you were to compare them to a child without ADHD, from what I've read, it's a lot of the frontal lobe functioning. So you said that we can't see it with blood tests or scans, but are there any structural or functional differences in the brain of a child who has ADHD?
Yes, there are, and on several levels. So I mentioned earlier, it's a bit about how different parts of the brain talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So there's also connectivity differences between the brains of children with ADHD and children who don't have the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. We also see some structural differences. They are subtle. It's not like you can scan them. There's no missing parts in the brain or, you know, nothing like that. It really is things that we see when we compare huge groups of children. And so really how the neurons are connected in some key parts of the brain that control attention and that control behavior. And we see also some difficulties in the chemical signaling between the neurons. This is what, like, we're going to talk about that later, but that's how the medication for ADHD works, is it increases dopamine, which is a chemical that you find a lot in the frontal lobe of the brain, mm-hmm. In that region specifically and in other parts of the brain to help it function better, to make it more efficient.
Okay. Yeah. And I think we'll get more into that with the medication, because that's a big question that came up with parents.
Yeah, I imagine. So
let's try to divide our conversation today into mm-hmm. age groups. So I think starting with, well, we sort of touched on that, but let's just start with younger children. So, mm-hmm. you know, before they start school, I received some emails from early childhood educators who are wondering, mm-hmm. you know, the behavior or hyperactivity in children who can't focus. So mm-hmm. if we, at this point, if they're too young, as you mentioned, then it's not really an age where we could diagnose them, but we're seeing children that really stand out in terms of, you know, not being able to sit down and do an activity mm-hmm. or focus for a long period of time. So yeah. What can these, you know, early childhood educators do if they have a child who's like this?
Well, as a clinician, my first question would be to try to figure out why they're doing that. So that's the part, like when they're in daycare, when they haven't started school yet, mm-hmm. that's when you want to try to eliminate all the possible causes of inattention or agitation. Is it because they're very anxious? Is it because they have poor social skills or something like that? Or is it mm-hmm. because they're, or sometimes it's just environmental, just by chance the child ends up in a group in daycare where just by chance there's a lot of disruptive children, and sometimes mm-hmm. that can affect a child and make the child less focused because there's too much going on in their environment. And next year, if they're in a different group that with more quiet children, you won't see these problems anymore.
Ah, okay. What about sleep, lack of sleep in young children, or even excessive screen time?
Well, that's one thing that we want to look at too. So if the child has never had to sit with an activity ever, like, or play a game with others ever, because they're just constantly on the phone or tablet, mm-hmm. and I mean, they're not, once they're in daycare, they're not going to be able to do that because they just haven't been trained to do it. They're just not used mm-hmm. to it. The other thing is, yes, sleep. Sleep is something that we, lack of sleep for, like poor sleep for one night, you should be fine. But yeah. It's when it's consistent, when it's prolonged, like disturbance of sleep, that's something that can impact your attention and your ability to control your behavior. So that we usually, when we do the clinical interviews, we ask about sleep and if the child wakes up constantly, like if they have a lot of nightmares, or do they also, interestingly, do they snore? Because children, like young children that snore are, the medical doctor that works at our clinic told me that it's not normal. So a child that's very young that snores, it warrants a visit to the doctor and telling them about it and see, is there an obstruction? Are they not? That's when they will look into, do they need to have their tonsils removed, or like if there's any, sometimes they're too big and it that makes them not statuate, a little bit like they have sleep apnea, but
yes. Okay.
So that's something to watch out for. Yeah.
Okay. So now, you know, that would be a younger child. Yeah. And so now let's say a child who begins school, let's say grade one, maybe kindergarten to grade two, a teacher might notice that they're having trouble with a certain child because, again, they can't focus. So, or their behavior is, you know, off and they're having trouble getting them to pay attention and sit down. Mm-hmm. I often speak with teachers who feel that they have many undiagnosed children in their classroom, but I'm trying to think of, you know, you just said before, like, you know, it might be other things, but what are some clear signs that a teacher might have to, you know, tell a parent, you know, perhaps your child should get evaluated?
Right. Well, I guess the clearest sign would be that the child, the teacher has tried all the flexibility measures they're allowed to try with the kid, and it's still significantly impacting his learning or his social relationships. There's no sign that really says, okay, if they have this one symptom, that means it's for sure ADHD.
Because so it's complex.
A lot of things can look like it, and it's not always obvious to the teacher, because they, you know, they might not see the anxiety, or they might not see, like, if they're having problems at home, or so basically what you want to see is, there are some things that the teachers can do to help the child focus that has trouble in these early years, is seating them, like a preferential seating, so giving them a seat closer to the teacher, farther away from any possible distractions, trying to minimize the distractions around the child, and calling to them a few times to make sure they understood that they're paying attention. They can also use, if the school allows, some motor toys to allow the child to contract his muscles while he's sitting down.
Are those the fidget toys?
Yeah, the fidget toys. Well, there has to be a motor, like a muscle contraction, for it to work as something that increases vigilance and attention. So the fidget spinners that were very popular, that doesn't work, because there's no muscle contraction. It really, it's like you can either, it's like a stress ball works, or sitting on, there's like a, you know, these big exercise balls, like the Swedish exercise ball you can sit on, wobbly, there's wobbly stools that exist. You can also use like a weighted lap lizard.
It sounds pretty interesting.
Right. So sometimes the very agitated kids with a bit of pressure on their muscle, with like a heavy blanket or plushie, it'll encourage them to sit more still, to be more still. The other thing is, they can wrap an elastic band around the legs of their chair that they can push or pull on it with their legs. So all of these allow them to contract muscle and move while sitting down. So these are things that they can try. So if they've tried that and the child is using them, and still after a few weeks they see that there's an impact of their attention on either their social relationships or their schoolwork, that's when they should tell the parents, maybe go see a medical doctor first. And the best course of action, or the best way of saying it, is to describe what the teacher observes in class. mm-hmm. and say, like, maybe not say right away, I think your child has ADHD.
I know. Yeah.
Your child is being inattentive, has a lot of difficulty focusing, or is very agitated, and I've tried a few things and it's not working. Maybe it's time to go see a doctor and tell them about it, ask what it could be. Try to figure out what the cause of it could be.
I think the way you phrase it is really important, because some teachers that I've spoken with say they get a lot of resistance mm-hmm. from parents. But it might be also in the way that they approach it, or in the way they introduce the subject, because, I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it is to be a parent that has a child who's not doing well in school, and then all mm-hmm. of a sudden you're getting this possible diagnosis, or, you know, this term ADHD being brought up, you know. And
yeah,
no, so I understand the resistance, but then, you know, this is a good segue into the next part of our conversation, which is mm-hmm. a child who does go through evaluation and a child who is diagnosed with ADHD. So what happens, let's say, once they come into your office, mm-hmm. what's the evaluation like?
Right, well, it's just before I get into that, I should probably mention that in Quebec and probably the rest of Canada, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. medical doctors, psychologists, and neuropsychologists can diagnose ADHD.
Okay. Even I didn't know that even the medical doctors, I thought they had to come yes. see a psychologist. Okay. Okay.
No, good. They definitely can. So the medical doctors and psychologists, what they will do is a clinical diagnosis or clinical interview. That's how it's through interviewing the parents, observing the child. That's how they are ideally supposed to do a differential diagnosis, try to see, like, okay, the child is agitated and attentive. What are the possible causes? Let me eliminate it. See, is it ADHD? That's also what we do in neuropsychology. We do that part, but we add an extra step, which is testing the children's skills with objective tests. So these are pen and paper tests or tests on the computer, and we will mm-hmm. go look at several functions of the brain and really measure them, compare them to an average for their age, and see mm-hmm. are there skills that are not where they should be for their age, and how far, and if they are below average, how far are they from average? Because we are looking, it's a neurological disorder, so we're looking at not just a little bit below average, but quite a bit below average mm-hmm. for it to be significant. So that's what we do. Usually we will meet with the parents first, and then have them fill out questionnaires, and we're going to ask them about the early development of their child, their habits at home. Like, we'll go through a whole bunch of things, like of possible symptoms. We'll ask them, are there tics? Are there like social difficulties? Like, we'll go through all the possible neurodevelopmental diagnoses. And then that's going to also help us determine what are the skills we should test in the child. Then after that, we see the child, and then we're going to do actual testing with the child with some normalized tests.
And here in Quebec, how, just to understand the system, you know, mm-hmm. in case there's a parent listening who wants to have their child yeah. evaluated. So if I were to go to my child's pediatrician, mm-hmm. they could do the evaluation themselves right away.
Yep.
Or okay, and then if I want to see a neuropsychologist to get a bit more of the evaluation, as you were talking about, how yeah. do I get to you? How do I get my child evaluated?
Well, for children, unfortunately, in the public healthcare system, the wait list, like, it's possible to get a referral from your pediatrician if they're unsure. Mm-hmm. Usually they're, like, if it's a really clear case for them, if they do, like, a thorough job, they will be able to determine, is it ADHD or not, and mm-hmm. should there be a treatment, and that's all you need, and, you know, for that's going to be it. If they're unsure, or that's when they might refer you to a psychologist or neuropsychologist for a more thorough evaluation. They can refer to a hospital or a CLSC. The wait lists are quite long, though, and it's significant mm-hmm. for children, you know, especially if they're, like, failing their classes. Mm-hmm. So it is... there is still a wait list in private clinics. You can, and in private clinics, you don't need a referral from a pediatrician or family doctor. you can just call and make an appointment. Just explain what you need the evaluation for. Mm-hmm. But then it costs something. That's the difference. There's still a bit of a wait list, but it's not as long as the public healthcare system.
Okay. And then, so once your child receives that diagnosis, I think the first question that comes to or pops up in a parent's mind is, mm-hmm. will my child have to take medication? And, you know, that's something, especially if you're talking about, you know, a 7 or 8 year old child. A lot of parents have a bit of that fear of starting their child mm-hmm. on medication. Will they be on this medication the rest of their lives? How will it, or what sort of side effects will my child have if they take mm-hmm. these medications? So do you recommend medications right away, or do you recommend, you know, that they test a few things out and then start meds? What's your opinion on this?
Well, the way we're working at our clinic, it might not be exactly the case for like all the neuropsychologists out there. But the way we work in our clinic is that usually when we do confirm an ADHD diagnosis, ADD or ADHD, mm-hmm. If it's a mild severity and if there's no other diagnoses, we are not going to recommend medication as the first solution. We're usually going to recommend parents to meet with the school with our report, because we write a whole evaluation report that we give to the parents. We ask them bring that report to the school, have them read it, have them read our recommendations for accommodations in class, and you yourself read the recommendations for home. Mm-hmm. and we're going to try that first. We're going to try to modify the child's environment to maximize their attention and their self-control. And if that doesn't work, then we will consider medication. If ADHD is moderate to severe, or if there are other problems like learning disorders or anxiety or any other things that don't have a medication for them, in that case, we might recommend medication. Mm-hmm. Neuropsychologists don't prescribe medications in Canada. For medication, you have to talk to a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. Same thing, we will say, well, take this report, take it to your medical doctor and discuss the options with them. But we can still discuss some of the medication. So in the case where all the accommodations don't work, usually the first treatment will be psychostimulants, which is the regular medication that we hear about. So Ritalin, Adderall, Bifantin, Concerta, Vivance, these types. So these are mm-hmm. the names of a few of them. And mm-hmm. So nowadays there's different molecules to choose from. These that, like I said before, their job is to basically increase the amount of connectivity in the frontal lobe of the brain. And this will help the frontal lobe better control all the other functions of the brain. So mm-hmm. control attention, control behavior. These medications, these are the ones, they're easy to manage because you give them in the morning to the child, and by the end of the day, there's nothing left in their system. Like, it's all gone. There's no more effect. And it works, and because of that, it works right away, usually. There's like a mm-hmm. 3-4 days like habituation period, but as soon as you give it, you should see beneficial effects. The side effects that happen with these medications, they're the ones that we hear about, is there might be some decrease in appetite over lunch, like in the middle of the day when the medication is at its most effective. Mm-hmm. However, appetite should come back for supper at the end of the day, and the child should even, you know, compensate for what they didn't eat over lunch. So this is something, so, you know, if you have a prescription from a doctor and you see your child is not eating, not even at supper, and, you know, there's a big difference, so this is a big concern, it's a good reason to go back to the doctor and tell them about it and say either the dose is wrong or we need to change molecule. Mm-hmm.
Because dose is something they could play around with, right? In terms of to see like what fits your child best, I guess you could.
Yes. And not all types of psychostimulants will work for all children.
Okay.
So the other things to watch out for is impact on sleep. It's not supposed to be last, the effect is not supposed to last so long that the child is unable to go to bed at night. Okay. Right. If that happens, that's probably the medication is having an effect, or like the body is not eliminating it as fast as it should. So that's also a good reason to go back to the doctor and tell them, my child's not sleeping. We need to lower the dose or change the molecule. The other thing is increase in anxiety. Because it's a psychostimulant, sometimes it's not supposed to create anxiety out of the blue. But if you have a child who already has a tendency to be anxious, it can exacerbate it a little bit. So if that's something you notice, that a child becomes either very emotional or very anxious, like a lot more than before, and it's impacting, like doesn't want to go to school anymore because they're too stressed, that's also a good reason to go back to the doctor. I have had some parents come to the clinic, and well, sometimes that's the thing, they get the diagnosis from a doctor, but they are not convinced by it. And that's when maybe like a couple, they've been prescribed a medication, but then a couple of years after, they're like, well, we figured we wanted a bigger evaluation, a more thorough evaluation to be really sure that we're not giving this medication for no reason. So we can do that. And also, sometimes one of the mistakes that parents make is that they leave with their first prescription the doctor gives them and never go back. And no matter what happens, they just say, oh, well, that's how it is. Or they just stop the medication. They realize there's too many side effects and they just stop it and they don't go back to the doctor to try something else.
Okay.
The other last thing to watch out for is usually that happens if the dose is too high. That's when you have the zombie children. Okay, that's also another, that's also something that we hear about a lot, that people have seen children in their environment, like either like their nephews, or like there's a little kid in the same school as my kid, and he's like, they've put him on medication and now he's like a zombie. Okay, that's not supposed to happen.
Okay.
This is usually when the dose is too high, they become they're like flat a little bit.
They're not. So that's another sign that the dose is wrong, or the molecule.
It's not well adjusted, or it's not the appropriate treatment for that child. So that's also something, like they're not supposed to lose the spark in their eyes. Okay. So the other category of medication, so if you've tried like all the psychostimulants that exist and like none of them work, or there's too many side effects even at the lowest doses, the other option could be a non-psychostimulant medication, which is a bit more complicated to manage, because this type of medication is one that will require a few weeks before you see the full effect of it.
Oh, okay.
And it's not something that you can stop. Like if you forget a dose, there's more potential for adverse reaction. Whereas psychostimulant, if you forget a dose, it's just, the only effect is that your child is going to have a lot of ADHD symptoms. So these non-psychostimulant medication, like Intuniv or Strattera, but I don't think Strattera is approved for younger children, but these types of medication, they're a bit more complicated to manage, but they have a lot less side effects. And they're usually given even before bed because they help the child fall asleep.
Oh, okay. And with the psychostimulants, I've heard of parents who stop the medication on weekends and then start it again on a Monday. Is that something that's recommended, or you want a consistent dose?
It is something that used to be done quite a lot. But as I said, in the clinic I work at, we do have a medical doctor that specializes in ADHD, and a lot of this information on medication I have is thanks to her. She doesn't recommend that anymore, because there is, when you start a psychostimulant medication, you will have this Red Bull effect in the first few days, where your child is going to be very energetic. After a couple of days, this side effect should disappear, and the only thing that should be left is improved attention and self-control. However, if you stop it even for 2 days, that's long enough for this Red Bull effect to reappear come Monday.
Ah, okay.
So it's not recommended anymore. I have sometimes recommend, like if you want to stop it for the summer though, like because it's a longer period, that's usually something that the doctors will be okay with. The other thing is, if you want to reduce dose for the weekend, that's something that can be discussed with a medical doctor, probably.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so now we've discussed, you know, the recent diagnosis, and I'd love to have a better understanding of what a student with ADHD would struggle with in school. You've mentioned, we've briefly mentioned cognition and social as well. You don't think about that often, but there are social difficulties that a child will experience, right? I'm going to end part one of our episode on ADHD here. And in part two, we'll cover more about what happens once a child receives the diagnosis of ADHD. So we'll look at what you can do to help them with their homework, what a teacher could do to help them in the classroom. And also, we'll talk more about these anxiety symptoms that a lot of children have that could be misdiagnosed as ADHD. If you're enjoying the Curious Neuron podcast, please take a moment to rate it on iTunes or Spotify. Remember to follow Curious Neuron on Instagram or Facebook to vote for the topics that I'll discuss on this podcast and to submit your questions that you would like me to ask the experts. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and until next time, stay curious.